Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, looking back at a year that was tumultuous in so many ways, this talk by author Walter Isaacson stands out as something that has almost nothing to do with our modern-day trials and tribulations. His latest book is a biography of Leonardo da Vinci. Isaacson's appreciation for and curiosity about his subject is evident here. He takes us along as he discovers, reveals really, the life of one of the most creative geniuses ever to walk the earth. As he refers to slides in his presentation, you may miss not being in the audience or find yourself gracefully drawn into imagining the scenes he describes. Walter Isaacson is an author, journalist, and the president of the Aspen Institute, a nonpartisan forum for values-based leadership and the exchange of ideas. His biographies include Steve Jobs, Benjamin Franklin, and Albert Einstein. The Elliott Bay Book Company presented this talk by Walter Isaacson at the Broadway Performance Hall on October 30th. Sonia Harris recorded his presentation. Here, Elliott Bay's Rick Simonson introduces Walter Isaacson.
Welcome and thank you very much for being here. Thank you for making the short walk over from Elliott Bay, if you came here by way of Elliott Bay. But for all of us, we're delighted in again being able to present Walter Isaacson. And maybe I can talk about Elliott Bay. It was the closest we've been to Elliott Bay, and his previous visits have included Town Hall and the Seattle Public Library. He is here tonight traveling around the country for an extraordinary and beautiful book. And though he's written some wonderful and terrific books in the past, I don't think the word beautiful is what would be so generously applied to them. But this book, Leonardo da Vinci, both in the writing, but also as you'll see, as you've begun to see in your copies, the book carrying artwork, design work, which is part and parcel of Leonardo da Vinci's doing, is part of this book. But the other part, and the part you'll get to hear a little bit, and then as you begin to read, and many other people have been starting to really read this book, is his life, his times, something that Walter Isaacson's done in a series of books, one line of them tracing unique, you could call them individuals of genius or kind of singular individuals, the most recent of those such books being the book on Steve Jobs, but also Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin. He's done those books and received great and attention and kind of this way of his looking at these individuals who are also part of a time, life and times in each case. He also, however, has been a master at writing sort of collective books, studies of groups of people or groups of individuals. The Wiseman book that covers a group of six individuals, or the most recent one, The Innovators, which may have come out of the world of the tech chain, you know, all the dynamic things with the tech world that Steve Jobs on one hand carried personified, but also just the way this has worked in other ways. So he's done all this in a way that carries with it both wonderful writing, which is not easily always something that gets brought off by people presenting big stories about complex people, but also it really stands up. I mean, you see all the notes and all the archival information in the back noted, and someone like Leonardo, whose life and times, we're talking 15th to early 16th centuries, you know, so many people have studied and written about him in part or in whole, and to step in and do so as Walter Isaacson's done here is really a testament to what he has done, as reviews have been showing and attesting. We were talking a little beforehand, the British usually get really picky about some of these things, and so far the most critical they've been is that the edition that's published in Britain got published with American spelling. They get huffy about that. Wait a minute, this book, these words aren't spelled. But that's it. Otherwise, they've praised what he's done. And so you will get to see and hear more of this as he's up here shortly. Walter Isaacson is still a professor, university professor of history at Tulane University. and is not teaching this fall, I believe, but he will be coming up soon. He is been the former CEO, he's the CEO of the CNN, and also editor of Time magazine. So he's also been in the world of covering, you know, news and looking at how all of that happens and is distilled what eventually becomes history. And so as the evening goes along and we talk about someone like Leonardo, who was of a time but speaks to this time, we have this ways of, he is one of those people that can probably also look and see, think of now as will be seen and known someday. So he will talk and show images for part of this, and then we'll take questions. He won't bump the microphone like I just did. And following that, you get to go home and start reading, which I think will be a great pleasure. It's fun to watch everyone walk around carrying their books. So, we do have copies in the lobby out here of the other books, which if you haven't availed yourself of, they're definitely ones to read. So, again, for everyone at LA Bay Book Company, we thank you very much for being here. And now, please ask you to please join in welcoming the wonderful and writer, Walter Isaacson.
Thank you very much. And I will say that he's right, it is a very beautiful book. Not because of me, but the guy who did the paintings and illustrations for it, he was spectacular. So you'll indefinitely enjoy them. I think this is my fourth trip back to one of my favorite cities, Seattle, for book tour. I mean, I've been here many other times for Elliott Bay. And having written first on Benjamin Franklin, then Einstein, then after I did both of them, Steve Jobs called up and said, do me next. I said, yeah, sure, Ben Franklin, Einstein, you. But I began, like Leonardo was so able to do, to notice a pattern. And the pattern was not that these were very smart people, although they were, but smart people, as you know, are a dime a dozen. You know, they don't usually amount to much. What really matters is being imaginative, being creative. And so I was looking for the pattern of what helps creativity, what brings forth imagination. And one of the things I noticed was when Steve Jobs was doing his product launches, he always ended with a street intersection sign of the arts and technology. And he said, if you stand at that intersection, that's where creativity occurs. And so I kind of noticed that. That was the pattern, because Benjamin Franklin loved everything from how the wind whirls, and he helped figure out the Gulf Stream, but also electricity. We think of him as a doddering old dude flying a kite in the rain, but those electricity experiments were the most important science experiments of his time. And, of course, governance and publishing and writing. And I realized that having that feel for all forms of nature helped make him so creative. And having done so, talking to Bill Gates, who had bought the Codex Lester, Steve Jobs, I realized that the ultimate in this procession, the person who best combined the arts and sciences, the person whose drawing of the man standing in the circle in the square exemplifies that connection, was Leonardo da Vinci. You know, Leonardo was had the great good fortune to be born out of wedlock. And by that, I mean, had he not been illegitimate, he would have been, like his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, a notary. And he would have been a truly awful notary. He was always thinking out of the box, challenging received wisdom, all the things you don't want your notary to do. He also was self-taught because he couldn't be sent to a university. So he grows up in this town of Vinci, this little village outside of Florence, and he starts trying to list all the things he wants to learn. The lists that he has in his notebooks are deeply inspiring, not because they're the most brilliant questions, but because they're the questions that we used to ask when we were kids, but somehow we outgrow our wonder years. But throughout his life, every week, he's marking down the things he wants to teach himself. Like, why is the sky blue? Does a bird wing flap up faster or down faster? How do they walk on ice in Flanders? What muscles and nerves twitch the eyebrows, and which ones do the lips? And my favorite of all of his little questions in his notebook is, describe the tongue of the woodpecker. Like, whoa, when I saw that one, it's like, wait, who gets up in the morning and puts on their to-do list, describe the tongue of the woodpecker? How would you even find out? You know, get a woodpecker, open the mouth, you know. And I laughed, and if you read the introduction, because early on I started sketching it out, I kind of make fun of it. Like, why would he care that much about the tongue of the woodpecker? But being one of these very curious people, he loves flows of water. He makes little dams in the river like we used to when we were kids. And he loves how the water is diverted and why it forms swirls. That becomes a question. Why does water flowing next to an obstacle form eddies and swirls? Is it like the way air forms the eddies and swirls? And so then he gets moved to Florence. At age 12, he goes to Florence and realizes that he can make all of these connections of nature, art, engineering, science, geology, because it's a city that's filled with diverse types of people. It is like 500 years ago in 1452 when Leonardo was born. It's when Gutenberg first starts printing. It's when people start coming from the fall of Constantinople to bring math from the Arab world. It all comes into Florence with all these wonderful patrons in Florence, and they love connecting art and engineering. Brunelleschi has just built the dome of that cathedral right in the center. And Leonardo gets to work in Verrocchio's shop. Verrocchio was an artist, an artisan, a painter, a sculptor, an engineer. And he did plays and pageants. He was a jack of all trades, a perfect place for a kid like Leonardo to learn his trade. Among the things they did right when Leonardo first gets there is there's a copper ball. Those of you who've been to Florence know it, on top of the Duomo. And it was Leonardo, as a young 12-year-old, who helps put the copper ball up there and helps figure out how to solder the copper, because they didn't have welding torches back then, but he helped build the mirrors that focus the light rays to make it. It's really good because we get to know exactly what Leonardo looked like as a kid. Verrocchio puts out statues of David. It was one of the common themes back then. And we have a drawing of one of the apprentices in the shop showing Leonardo posing for the statue of David. And there's even Leonardo's own little self-portrait, which he does at the edge of the Adoration of the Magi. So we see the flowing, curly, golden hair, the well-proportioned and graceful body, as the people back then wrote about Leonardo. And he had that certain angelic beauty to him, and he knew it. He liked being good-looking and sort of paraded it around. As a apprentice in Verrocchio's shop, one of the things they do is a lot of the pageants. This is Leonardo's first drawing on the left, and everybody's wondering, why did he do that? But if you look through the notebooks, you see it was part of a pageant they put on for a visit to Florence by the Duke of Milan. And you see the bird's wing, because Leonardo loved the way bird's wings worked. But he combines great observation with great fantasy. Something else we did during our wonder years until we were told to quit daydreaming, quit fantasizing. But so there are lions and there's swirls and there's bird wings and everything on it. And they make this wonderful set of costumes. And we see the role of pageants and plays and theater helping to shape him both as an artist and an engineer. For example, his famous helicopter. People say, oh, he invented the helicopter. Well, this drawing of the helicopter or aerial screw that he does was first done for a play that was put on in Florence in the 1470s when Leonardo was a young kid there. And he helped make the ingenious props, ingenue, they called it, bringing the angels down from the rafters. But one of Leonardo's great talents is that he let fantasy blur into reality. So later he says, okay, let's build real flying machines. And he spends a lot of his life trying to figure out how to do man-made flying machines and gliders. He also very much loves, ever since being a kid, looking at the rivers in Vinci, he loves how the flow of water connects us to the earth and to our environment. In fact, the great metaphor in his life is the flow of water or the rivers of the earth are analogous to the flow of blood in the veins of human, and the waters of the earth flow into us and sort of connect us to the world around us. Nowhere is this more obvious than in his very first painting he worked on. This is a painting by Verrocchio's studio. Back then, they were all very collaborative in the way they did paintings. And Leonardo does both the angel on the bottom left and the background. And you see the River Jordan coming from the eons of time, winding and flowing like those rivers he loved, and connecting to the body of Jesus, very literally almost, because John the Baptist is pouring the water there. But if you look at the feet, you see the perfectly rendered, scientifically accurate way that water ripples past the ankles of Jesus, the perfect sedimentation layers, perfect geology. It's something he had drawn over and over again in Bill Gates's notebook, the Codex Lester, the one he bought of Leonardo. It's all about the flow of waters and ripples. He also is able to convey emotion the way other painters of the time didn't do. It was one of the many things that Leonardo contributes to the world of art. The angel on the far left is his. That angel looks like in motion, looks like he has just landed, turning the neck, but also the face is so very expressive. Leonardo walked around town with his notebooks, drawing faces of people and saying, how do their expressions connect to their inner emotions? The angel next to him, which was painted by Verrocchio, has actually very little seeming emotion other than seeming to think, how did I get next to this most amazing angel next to me? The other painting he does as a young painter in Florence is a cloth merchant's wife. We're going to see at the end, of course, the most famous painting of a cloth merchant's wife. This isn't the Mona Lisa, but this is clearly the painting of the young artist who would eventually go on to paint the Mona Lisa. Once again, the rivers coming from the eons of history and connecting us to nature, the perfect light and shadows and shade hitting the sparkles of the curls he so loved, and a face that doesn't quite have the mysterious emotion of the Mona Lisa, but you can tell he's trying. That is not just a typical Renaissance portrait. Clearly something is going on inside. One of the odd things about Leonardo is there's quite a few paintings he doesn't finish. One of them is the Adoration of the Magi, also done during his early 20s now. He's in Florence, but it shows how complex the drama and movement of his paintings are becoming. Because as somebody who loved the theater, he doesn't just paint a moment in time. This is a swirl, a whirl, as if it's a narrative, as if you're watching a scene unfold on the stage. The very bottom right, you see the second king offering his gift. The first king is already bowing down, and then it swirls like the shape that Leonardo loved, so that each person's emotion is affecting the next person next to him. By the way, at the very bottom right, if you can see it, is that self-portrait I showed you earlier, where the artist always puts himself, Leonardo, with his golden curls, looking outward from the scene. He also has another unfinished painting in his 20s when he's in Florence, St. Jerome in the Wilderness. And this gives us a hint, or, you know, when I studied it, I found out a hint of why he sometimes didn't finish paintings. It wasn't that he abandoned them. It's that he wanted to make them perfect, and so he just kept them. This one he keeps. Actually, when he leaves Florence and goes back and forth, he leaves it with a close friend of his, named Vespucci, whose cousin, Amerigo Vespucci, is going off to discover America at that point in the 1490s. And you see in the neck of St. Jerome a perfectly rendered set of muscles. This is a little puzzling because Leonardo had not yet done his anatomy studies. People then did not know that the muscles of the neck work that way. In fact, the middle drawing is just a drawing that he did at the time where the muscles are incorrect. So how did he get it right then? And that forms the clue of what he did with his paintings, because on the very far right are his anatomy studies of the human neck, where he dissects the human body. But he does those 25 years later. And that's when he discovers how the neck muscle looks, and he goes back. Because if you study and look using technical means to look at St. Jerome, you discover that the neck was painted over 20 years later. He used a different type of oil glaze and decided to make it better. So here we see Leonardo not so much abandoning paintings as saying there's always something more I can learn, always a different field I can figure out, and that's why he holds on to his paintings. Most of this comes to me from his notebooks. Other people who've written about Leonardo over the past century or so generally focus on his 15 or 16 great painting masterpieces and build their study on that. But having many years ago, 10, 12 years ago, been here in Seattle and had the chance to look at the notebook that Bill Gates bought, the one that mainly does science, geology, friction, mechanics, called the Codex Lester, I realized that it would be fun to just go page by page through the 7,200 still existing notebook pages around the world that you can find of Leonardo to say, what was he thinking every day? That's where you see the wonderful lists. That's where you see a mind dancing across many of nature's wonders. Paper was a great technology for the storage of information. After 500 years, you can still retrieve the information, unlike our Facebook posts and tweets, which hopefully won't be around 500 years from now. It was also good because they had just really invented rag paper in Florence. It was a little expensive, so he crammed as much as he can on the pages. In this one, for example, you see the craggy old warrior with the curly hair. That was sort of a doodle that he loved to do. But what he also has, if you look very closely, is a tree trunk going into the torso of the old man. And that's because he's just discovered Leonardo's law of branching, which says if you have branches coming off of a trunk and you do the cross sections, the area of the total area of each of the branches will equal the total area of the cross section of the trunk. And as always, he's making that connection between nature and us. How do we fit in to nature? And so he realizes that's the way our veins work as well. So you see his mind doing that. Coming out of the back of the old warrior is both mountains, but also geometrical figures of triangles. Up at the top left, you see him doing that swirls of water, his favorite of all patterns, but then comparing it to swirls of air, and then as you see right below the very top there, a curl of hair. In the notes, he writes about the same form, the same spiral, doing the way that water curls and hair curls. And he asks, why? What causes curls? The type of thing that we used to ask before we quit asking questions. And there you also see his geometric drawings, because now he's in his late 20s and he's become obsessed with the transformation of shapes. How do you turn one shape into another of the same size? Most notably, how do you square a circle? An ancient riddle of creating a circle that's the exact same area as a square, a given square, using only a ruler and a protractor. It's hard to do because pi is an irrational number. But there's Leonardo, just finding out different ways to do it. And on the left-hand side are more of those to-do lists. How do they walk on ice in Flanders? How do they make the locks work to divert the rivers here? All the questions until the very bottom, in which he says how to boil nuts in oil in order to make what he calls a tawny hair dye. We realize he's human. Here's a guy about to turn 30, a little bit vain about his appearance, totally beautiful golden curly hair, and he thinks, uh-oh, I may be going gray, and he helps invent the hair dye. As I said, he was a bit of a misfit in Florence, not only illegitimate, but a little bit heretical, a vegetarian, left-handed, all of his notebooks are in mirror script from one side to the other, also gay. And at this point, at age 30, he finds a companion that is with him most of his life, Salai, nickname actually Salai for the little devil. But he's a devilish person who keeps sort of nicking things, breaking things, but it remains Leonardo's companion for most of his life with, as a contemporary says, those wonderful curls of hair that Leonardo so luxuriated in. So we watch over the years in the notebook too as pictures of Salai age. But then, having turned 30, having worried about going gray, having done two paintings that he didn't finish in which the contracts for those paintings had been notarized by his father, he realizes it may be time to leave town. He's had a bit of a falling out with his father, who's guaranteed these two contracts, and his 20-something kid didn't finish them. I think we kind of know how that is. So he went as part of a delegation to Milan, and it was a cultural envoy, a cultural diplomacy delegation, because Florence didn't have much of an army. But it had enormous influence because so many of its artists and artisans went to other cities sent by the Medici family. And it was sort of a form of soft power, cultural diplomacy back then, just like we used to do so well in this country. And the Medici send this delegation led by a playwright and a poet. It has architects, artisans, and Leonardo, at age 30, goes as a musician. This is in 1482, because he's designed musical instruments, including a lira da braca, a lyre, sort of harp for the arm, almost like a violin, but in the shape of a horse's head. But he clearly doesn't want to get back to Florence when the delegation is over. So instead, he writes one of the coolest job application letters ever. It's 11 paragraphs long. The first 10 paragraphs are things that deal with engineering, because he wants to think of himself as an engineer as much of an artist. First paragraph is, I can make weapons of war. You see some of them here. I can divert rivers. I can build castles that are impregnable. I can build great public buildings. Only in the 11th paragraph does he say, I can also paint. So he ends up getting work with the Duke of Milan, not really doing military drawings because or military inventions, because he combines fantasy a little bit too much, and most of the things wouldn't really work, but they're still very impressive. The main thing he starts with is buildings and architecture. Milan had the great cathedral. It didn't have what's called a Tiburio, which is that tower at the very top with a nave and transept cross. And so they ask a group of people to enter a competition to design the lantern tower. This ends up with the drawing I mentioned, I think the greatest drawing ever. But we think of drawings like that as being solo performances. What I'm here to show is like in The Innovators, where I wrote about the nature of creative collaboration, that creativity was a team sport back then. And Leonardo loved working with other people in the court of Milan. His best friends were Luca Pacioli, a mathematician. Leonardo does the drawings for his book. And Donato Bramante, who was an architect and artist like Leonardo. And they believe simplicity is the ultimate beauty. As you can tell from the Milan Cathedral, it's not simplicity. In fact, it's a grotesque monstrosity. And they design a very simple lantern tower that's a circle and a square, which is what Leonardo loved. That is not, however, as you can tell, what gets built by the authorities. But Leonardo and his friends have bonded on this notion of simple proportional church designs that reflect the proportions of a human. How do we fit in not only to the earth, how do we fit in not only to the cosmos, but how do we fit in to the spirit of everything around us? One of his two best friends was Donato Bramante. And fortunately, Bramante paints a picture of them. On the right-hand side is Bramante, balding and laughing. And there's Leonardo on the left, the notebook in front of him, having the mirror script, so we're absolutely sure that's Leonardo, that left it backwards running lines. There he is with his curly hair, well-proportioned, graceful body, as his friend said, and wearing the pink and purple that he loved to wear. And so they set out to create beautiful symmetrical churches. These are Leonardo's drawings involving the circle and the square in beautiful proportion. And they have read a book that has just been rediscovered, because the Renaissance was about the rediscovery of classical knowledge, as you've read about Lucretius being rediscovered in Stephen Greenblatt's The Swerve. Cicero had been rediscovered. And among the books rediscovered was a manuscript by an ancient architect named Vitruvius, who talked about how the proportions of a human should be reflected in the proportions of a building and of a temple and of a church. So here are Leonardo's designs that way, and they decide to go to Pavia, very near the town of Florence, to where they're building a new cathedral and where there's a copy of the ancient manuscript, Vitruvius's book on architecture. Vitruvius talks about each, not only that the proportions of a human should be reflected in a church, but he goes through each of the proportions, every single one, page after page. But Leonardo, who doesn't accept received wisdom, does his own experiments. We have about 30 notebook pages in which he does 230 different proportions of a human, from the chin to the lips to the nose, both standing and sitting and running and moving, making his assistants pose and he measured every single part of it. So Leonardo has all these proportions. He's also still geeking out, still drilling down on how do you square the circle. What are the ways you can do to turn a square into a circle? And so they travel, all of them, four friends, to Pavia, and they decide they're going to look at this Vitruvian manuscript, and they're going to illustrate it. They're going to show what Vitruvius is talking about. And that's the beautiful cathedral, the type they like in Pavia, nice and simple. And then his friends and he start drawing the illustration for how do we fit in to the spirit of the world. You have Francesco Di Giorgio, an architect from Venice, who was one of the friends, Donato Bramante, and on the right, Giacomo Andrea, his drawing of it. The cool thing about Giacomo Andrea is we actually know in July of 1492, right when they come back from Pavia, they have a dinner at Giacomo Andrea's house, and Leonardo brings his companion, Salai, who earns his nickname by breaking one of the pieces of crockery and then spilling a glass of red wine. So we can have this wonderful human scene of imagining all of them together trying to figure out this Vitruvian man concept and making sure that young Salai doesn't ruin their drawings. And then Leonardo does his version. Look at these. And then look at Leonardo's. You can tell the difference. It's in a different league. It is a piece of absolute brilliant scientific precision. He has the foot turned outward, so the foot becomes a measuring, and every proportion is exactly right. So scientifically, it's beautiful. It also takes Vitruvius's idea that the navel should be at the center of the circle, but that the genitals should be at the center as well, and realizes that he can put the genitals in the center of the square, the navel in the center of the circle. If he just takes the circle and square and has them on the same base, but the circle goes up higher. He's learned that from the notion of squaring the circle, that it should be higher. And besides being a work of great science and also ethereal mathematics, it is a work of almost unnecessary beauty. It is a work of art. The perfect shadings and cross-hatchings of Leonardo compared to the stick figures his friends are doing. Leonardo believes that beauty matters. So everything he does tries to be beautiful. And then you have, unlike his friends, the stare of a real human face, a very strong stare and you look carefully at that face, and you go back and check this out, and you realize it's a self-portrait. That there is Leonardo standing spread eagle, naked in the earth and in the universe, wondering, how do I fit in? So that's why this, to me, is the ultimate drawing of the connection of art and science to the spirit. Leonardo wanted to know everything that could be known about everything there was to know, about everything in the universe, including how we fit in. And this drawing is a symbol of it. He goes on to really invent the whole concept of visual display of scientific information, combining art and science, in ways that, with his anatomy experiments, show he's not just great as an anatomist, but he's great at drawing it so that we can understand it. Also, as a weapons of war, he works with Caesar Borgia, the warlord, and Machiavelli. The three of them holed up in the town of Imola in the winter of 1503. And what Leonardo invents is actually the best weapon of war he invents, which is the visual display of information of a city. He paces off with Salai each of the blocks in Imola, and then is able to imagine, this is before there were blimps or drones or balloons, how to do it from the air so it can be a map that can be used for Caesar Borgia. It reminds me of the maps you see in the Defense Mapping Agency in Washington and other places, that perfect aerial view. All of his science and art and engineering and math and perspective start coming together in his art. Kenneth Clark, among others, said it's a shame he wasted so much time on anatomy and math and rivers and geology, because he should have been painting more paintings. I think had he not been interested in every bit of the beauty of nature, he would have painted a lot more Ginevra da Vinci's, but he would not have painted The Last Supper or the Mona Lisa. The Last Supper, once again, shows the influence of the theater. You look at those walls coming in. He knows the math of perspective, but he's using tricks. The walls come in a little bit faster. Just as you would see on a stage like this, if Leonardo or anybody had done the scenery would be coming in at an angle to give you a perspective of depth. You also see it as a dramatic narrative. This isn't just a moment, but it's a narrative. It moves. You can imagine the monks coming in from the bottom right of that picture, seeing the hand of Jesus. They look up, and he's just said, "One of you shall betray me." And you look at the apostles next to him, and they've already heard the words, and they're saying, "Is it me, Lord? Who is it?" You go further out, and they're just beginning to hear it, so they're having different reactions, very theatrical reactions, too. And then it ripples back all the way to the point where you see Judas, as everybody says, "Is it me, Lord?" And Jesus says, "He that dippeth his hand with me." And there's Judas dipping the bread. And finally, the ripples come back to Jesus, and he's reaching forward, instituting the Eucharist, reaching for the bread and the wine. So you see a whole set of verses of the Bible in one narrative painting. When you see it in situation, too, you see the beauty of the science and the art all coming together. That window on the upper left is the real window in the dining hall. And if you go there and see it, the light comes in from that window, and then you look at the painting, and you notice, hey, the light is on the wall of the painting, on the right there, as if it's coming in from the window. And all of the shadows and light, even though the painting has the windows in the way back of the painting, but the light is as if it comes in from that window, making it all part of one whole. The other great painting that shows the connection of science and art is a painting that I dwell on in the book, not knowing that next week it'll start becoming very famous. This is Salvador Mundi. You may have read about it. It was rediscovered about 20 years ago, and it will be auctioned off at Christie's on November 15th. The only one of Leonardo's 15 paintings in private hands. And you see the blur that he does, the sfumato that he does of the face. But you also see that the right hand is so sharp, which is unlike Leonardo. It's because Leonardo had been looking not only at mathematical perspective, like we saw in the Last Supper, which he bends, but also what he's called in his notebooks acuity perspective, which is the sharpness of lines. If you're looking at me, I'm looking at you, the lines around our face or on objects are slightly blurred the way Leonardo paints them, because we have two eyes, we have big retinas, so we don't see a real sharp lines in nature. But there is a point right about here in which our eyes have the focal point and things are very sharp at that distance. And so with the right hand being that sharp, it does something Leonardo has really helped bring to art, which is to convey three dimensions on a two-dimensional panel. It looks like the hand is coming out at us. It looks like it's closer to us. And finally, there's the crystal orb. There's something scientifically odd about it. The inclusions, those three white specks, are exactly right. But if it's a crystal solid orb, it would actually diffract what's behind it. You sort of distort the lines behind it, sort of inverse them. Take a bottle of water, put your finger that way, you see things are refracted or distorted behind a crystal. And yet Jesus' robes aren't. There are three possible explanations. One is that Leonardo just didn't know. That's wrong. I mean, he had already, even in his notebooks then, he's talking about, remember how we put the copper ball on the Duomo, how we focused the light, how we refracted the light to form a soldering. And he's studying crystals for Isabella d'Este, the wealthiest woman in Italy, helping her pick them out. He's doing his lens experiments, almost inventing a telescope. He comes close. It took Galileo to do it, but he knows definitely how refraction occurs. The other explanation is he knew what it would be like, but he realized it would be very distracting. He'd look at the picture, and then all of a sudden, the robes would look weird. And so, like with the Last Supper, he decides to play tricks and not do it. I think that's probably the right explanation, but there's actually a slightly more appealing explanation, which is this is Salvador Mundi, Christ the Savior of the world, and he wants to impart the miraculous quality of Christ's stewardship of the world, that nothing he touches will be distorted. And so he's showing the miracle of him holding the world without it diffracting or distracting. He uses his understanding of spirals to actually come up with a great scientific discovery, which is that the heart valve, and when it opens and shuts, doesn't do so because of the pressure of the blood coming up and then pushing it back down. As he writes on the left-hand page, that would crumple the valve. He said it's because of the swirls, those swirls he so loved in nature, that the swirls pull out the membrane. And that's what makes it close and cover the opening of the heart valve. And he even does, in the upper right-hand part of that left-hand painting, a glass that he experiment, where he says, here's how you would do it in glass with grass seeds in it. And it's totally correct. People didn't know it then. It's only been proven in the past 40 years when they used MRI imaging to show exactly how the membrane is brought out by the swirl. But it's Leonardo looking at the patterns that happen across nature and getting a feel for them, like Ben Franklin did when he discovers the Gulf Stream and other great scientists who are interested in all sorts of fields and see the patterns across different disciplines. At the very end of his heart anatomy drawings, he draws one last page, starts drawing the heart again at the bottom right of that last page, and then his mind wanders a bit, and he decides to draw Salai with the heart inside, proving again that Leonardo is human. But the visual connection of art to science is vibrant in everything he does. That notion of water flowing into a pond, we see it every day. We see water flowing into a basin, every morning probably. But Leonardo spent his life saying, why when it flows in, do you get the swirls and curls? Why do the bubbles curl around? Do the bubbles help bring the swirls in a different way? All these little questions that are so obvious that we could ask them of ourselves. And after I worked on this book, I started asking myself, okay, watch the water go into the basin. Try to be more like Leonardo. Pause for a moment and see the beauty of the patterns. And finally, it culminates with, I think, the greatest painting ever. On the left-hand page, you see his dissection of the human eye, showing that at the very center of our cornea, we see sharp black and white details best. On the edges of the cornea, the cones and fovea see shadows and colors better. So if you're looking at something directly, you kind of see the details in black and white, but the colors come in a different way. He's also dissecting the human lips, every muscle and every nerve of the lips, page after page, showing exactly how the lips work. And on the last of those pages, on the right, if you look at the very top, very faintly, he's taking out a different piece of chalk. And in 1503, near the end of his life, in his 50s, he's starting to draw the most famous smile in history. He starts his painting in 1503, as I just said, but like his other paintings, he just doesn't deliver it or give it up. It's with him for the last 16 years of his life. It's a cloth merchant's wife, just like Ginevra da Benci, but it shows how a lifetime spent relishing the patterns of nature have deepened him not only as an artist, but as a philosopher, scientist, and engineer. And everything comes together in a painting that for 16 years he's just doing small, tiniest layers of glaze over the white primer coat so that there are many, many layers and the light comes in and bounces back. Once again, we see the river that connects us the eons of history to the road that connects our civilization, that connects to us as humans. How do we fit in to the cosmos? And then there's a smile. If you look at it very directly at the corner of the lips, the tiniest black and white details don't turn up. They turn down slightly. But you look at the shadows in the color, and they turn upward. That means the smile is elusive. The more you look for it, the less it's there. But if your eyes go to her forehead or to her chin, suddenly the smile goes on. It's interactive. It's a virtual reality. It's showing drama, even in just a portrait, a drama of motion and inner emotion flickering on and off as we react to it, and the painting seems to react to us. He brings it all the way to his deathbed across the Alps, where he works for the King of France, living in a manor house next to the chateau of the King of France. And on his very last notebook page, which we have here, of the 7,200 pages, he's still geeking out, still trying to square the circle, still trying to find ways to do, as Euclid taught, a right triangle with different lengths of leg. If you do it, maybe the triangles and the shaded areas. He explains it all on that page. He has the four drawings. He even puts a chart in the middle showing the four drawings. Until the very end, it breaks off. And he says, but the soup is getting cold. You can imagine him up in that room. Salai, Melzi, his other companions and students are downstairs. His cook, Marine, is downstairs. He's still hoping to get us one step closer to that notion of squaring the circle. But the soup is getting cold. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. Time for a couple questions if you want, or? No, I can learn a bit of Italian, but no, I was not a great Italian speaker, which wouldn't have helped that much because he wrote in a 15th century Florentine dialect in mirror script. I had a wonderful companion who's become a friend, in fact, came and visited me in Colorado this summer, named Marco Chianti, the first line of my acknowledgments. He had been the translator for an old scholar named Carlo Pedretti, who you may have heard of. Marco lives in the town of Florence, took us to Vinci, took us to go see Vitruvian Man in the fourth floor of the Academy, and he served as my translator. And to give one of your hometown boys a shout out, there will be a tremendously brilliant translation and annotation published probably next year of the Codex Leicester that Bill Gates is having Martin Kemp, who is another advisor of mine on this project, do with Domenico Lorenza. And they read all of my scientific translations in the Codex Leicester and gave me early access to that translation. But one of the things that should be done is his notebooks should all be compiled and all translated and all annotated in one place, and they aren't now, which was a hardship. It meant that Kathy and I, my wife and I, had to go all over the world to see them, to places like Venice and Florence and Milan and Paris and London and Windsor Castle and Seattle. Yes, oh, sorry. Yeah, the craggy old warrior. That is one of the things, and it's in the book, which is not only the craggy old warrior, but he loves to juxtapose the craggy old warrior with the young face. He does it at one point with Salai in one of them. And it is, I guess, just one of those doodles he likes, but it also shows him contemplating youth and age and differences, and it becomes one of the motifs of his life. The craggy warrior starts, I think, with the, on the far right, that's Salai and the craggy warrior. It starts, as I showed you earlier, with the theater drawings of, of the old warrior who was in the pageant. That's a craggy warrior there, the first drawing he does. But throughout his life, and you see on the right, the young, beautiful, almost androgynous, pretty boy profile. He loves juxtaposing those two. And there's even a section of the book that talks about pleasure and pain, which is a sort of parable he writes. And he shows them two joined. So it's a deeply psychological thing for him. Great. All right, last question there. Thank you. Yeah, I have actually a note about the cover in the very beginning, but I'll use this last question to talk about the mysteries of Leonardo, which is from the place he was born, like which little cottage in Vinci, to the deathbed scene I have up there. There's always mysteries about Leonardo. Did he really die in the arms of the King of France, like that painting? And even the portraits of him are sometimes disputed. That portrait on the cover was originally thought to be a self-portrait by Leonardo. I'm convinced it wasn't. There are multiple versions of it, and I think it was first done in approximately 1600, probably by somebody who at least knew people who knew Leonardo. There had been sketches like that, like in Vasari's Lives, but it is an iconic drawing, and I wanted to show him not as the old sage with the flowing beard, but have us remember that this is a real human, a good-looking guy, a person with a real intensity to him, who even during his lifetime was recognized as being both a genius, but also a very personable human guy who was painted often like by Donato Bramante, the one I showed you. And because I'm always worried about, is it exactly right? I explain the provenance of that painting and why I think it's probably the best likeness we have of Leonardo da Vinci. Thank you all very much for being here. I deeply appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for streaming this extra episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. And thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.